This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Before the fare goes up again, before the rooms are all booked, before everybody changes their mind, you need to get that vacation planned. For many people, step one means going online to see how others rate a destination, hotel, food, transport. Everybody wants a vacation deal, and more of us want to either brag about it or bemoan it afterwards. Today, creative and frugal ways to travel, from how to avoid that baggage check-in charge to the best fried frogs in Bangkok. Later in the hour, on the opinion page, Frank Rich on Memorial Day at the revival of South Pacific, and we'll listen in to portions of the ceremony earlier today at Arlington National Cemetery. But first, underground jazz clubs, exotic bazaars, flying lightly on the fly. Tell us about the great cheap stuff in your town. And remember, if that's New York, everybody knows about the delights of Central Park on a sunny day. Tell us something we don't know about New York or San Francisco, Ames, Iowa, or Baton Rouge, Louisiana. 800-989-8255 is the phone number. The email address is talk@npr.org. And you can send in a recommendation on our blog. That's at npr.org/blogofthenation. And let's begin with Phil. And Phil's calling us from Mitchell, South Dakota.
So, let's see. A great freebie is the world's only corn palace here in Mitchell, South Dakota. We are about 70 miles west of Sioux Falls off of I-90. It's free. See, what the corn palace is it's a civic center. It's designed in a Moorish type genre, where they have onion domes on top, flags, and then also the facade is designed by corn and other agricultural products. The theme of the murals change every year.
And what is the theme this year? Do you know?
I drive by the Corn Palace almost every day, and I forgot right now.
Okay.
But it's free.
It's free, okay.
Free and open to the public, and people from all over the world come to visit us.
Well, thanks very much for the recommendation, Phil. If we're in Mitchell, South Dakota, we'll be sure to drop by. Joining us now is Doug Diamond. He's the creator of OneBag.com, and he's with us from member station KQED in San Francisco. And nice to have you on the program today.
Thanks for inviting me, Neil.
And Doug, long before American Airlines announced that charge of $15 to check one bag, you've been telling people how to pack for a carry-on world.
I have. For over a decade now, I've been encouraging people to pack lightly and have a much more rewarding travel experience.
But how do you cram a 2 weeks' worth of clothes into one carry-on bag?
Well, mostly you figure out that you really don't need to take all that much with you for a two-week trip. I claim that you can go on a six-month trip with just a carry-on bag.
And a lot of quarters for the laundry.
Yes, laundry certainly enters into it, but it's the kind of laundry that you can mostly do yourself in your hotel room sink in the evening, maybe a 10-minute exercise after you brush your teeth every other day. So it's not a big deal, and given that it relieves you of the stress of hauling a wheeled vehicle around with you and all your belongings, I have always thought it's more than worthwhile.
What's ideal clothing for packing lightly?
Well, lots of things. Things that don't show wrinkles and dirt too easily, so generally darker pattern kinds of things, not too dark if you're going to hot countries. Generally, modern-day synthetic fabrics will do a better job for you than the traditional cottons and linens. And stick to a common color theme. So decide on perhaps two colors and make sure that everything that you carry with you goes with everything else.
And that's sometimes not so easy. But there's a few things that are just hard to pack. I mean, you're going to want to bring more than one pair of shoes.
Yeah, shoes are probably the single most difficult part of traveling lightly. But most people these days, certainly not all, but most people can get by with two pairs of shoes, a kind of dressy pair and a lighter, more of a casual sporting kind of pair. And given that you're wearing one of those pairs, you're really only worrying about packing one pair of shoes.
And then there's stuff that's, not clothing, lotions, hairspray for some people.
Well, the best way to get rid of a lot of that stuff is to eliminate the water in it. A lot of toiletry products are mostly water, and the notion of carting bottles and containers of water around the world, even aside from the security considerations, are not a very good one. So I just encourage people to look for solid substitutes, and you can find them for almost everything, for shampoos and various lotions and sunblocks and mascaras and all of that kind of thing. They all have solid replacements, which weigh less, don't spill, and aren't nearly as likely to mess up the rest of your plans.
And a couple of things that could mess up your plan to just carry one bag, though. Two things, really. One is if you're going someplace that's really cold.
Well, the secret there is just to use layering. People, I think, worry too much about temperature differences. Just last month, I spent a week in Moscow where the average temperature was just above 40, and then spent the following week on a direct flight from there where in India where the average temperature was 115, and I had no problems with it. The secret is not to think of dealing with cold weather by packing big, heavy garments, but by having more layers. And the packing list I use actually has 7 different layers, so anything short of an Arctic expedition, I'm pretty much covered for.
And the other problem could be if you're expected to look nice somewhere, if you have to bring a suit.
Yes, but that's on my list, and that goes in the bag. The problem with suits and things is you just have to learn how to pack them so that they don't get all wrinkled and creased looking. And there are techniques for packing things that take up minimal space and give you maximum protection against wrinkles and creases.
And do you advocate those bags we see advertised on TV where you can squeeze all the air out and make it even smaller?
No, you know, I've never really had a problem with there being too much air in my bag, so I've never thought those were a particularly good idea. Just adding more weight and bulk to my bag, I get rid of the air just by closing the lid of the bag.
Okay. What interests you in this? What drives you to do this?
Well, lots of time spent on the road, lots of time spent traveling over the years, and a background that includes science and engineering as my choice of things to do in life, and all of that coupled with a fairly anal personality has just led me to overanalyze everything I do, including travel and packing, and so I've just refined it over the years, and people find it interesting. They come to the website, so it's been an avocation that's turned into something that takes probably more of my time than it should, but it's a lot of fun.
And I have to ask you, what's the most interesting question one of your readers has posed to you?
Well, usually they're asking me for impossible things, like, here's a list of what I have to take. How do I fit that all in one bag? And, of course, the answer is that perhaps you don't. If you're going golfing or skiing or scuba diving, you're probably not going to get everything you want into the one bag. And my site really isn't about that. It's about learning to change the style, the way you travel, such that you don't need a lot of stuff with you. And as I say, I claim that you can travel indefinitely out of a bag that's well under the dimensions that the airlines will allow you to carry on.
And I have to ask, has happenstance ever caught you with more than one bag?
The only time I ever carry an additional bag is if I'm doing some business-related thing that requires me to bring something that's connected with the business that's too big to fit in my bag. But I mean, the brief answer to that question is no. I haven't intentionally checked a bag in probably 30 years.
Doug Diamond, we worship at your shrine. Thank you very much for being with us.
You're most welcome. Dude.
Doug Diamond is the creator of OneBag.com, and, well, he has advice there for how to pack lightly. We're talking about summer travel and how to get somewhere. And once you get there, well, what should you do that's cheap and sort of out of the way? Let's see if we can get another call around in the conversation. And let's go to Eric. Eric's with us from Donnelly in Idaho.
Hello, Neil.
Hi there.
Hi, just as far as getting off the beaten path and kind of a destination here in central Idaho, we do a lot of hot springing. We have the largest or one of the largest concentrations of natural hot springs in the world.
And once you get there, are they cool enough to get into?
Well, it depends. You know, it'll vary anywhere from 90-ish degrees up to way too hot to get into. But usually this time of year with the runoff in the summertime and everything, it's not bad.
And it's pretty astonishing to look at.
Oh, yeah. I mean, they're all in really beautiful settings. And, you know, some of them are day hikes, some of them are overnighters, and some are like 20 feet from the road. So
Eric,
just all kinds of variety.
Thanks for the advice for Central South Dakota. Central Idaho, excuse me. I was thinking about South Dakota because earlier we had a caller about the Corn Palace, which we are told through the miracle of the internet is decorated with locally grown corn. The process starts in the spring and is completed by the end of September. A different theme is chosen each year. Murals are designed to reflect that theme, and Sherry Ramsdell is the current panel designer, and Everyday Heroes is the theme for the 2007-2008 Corn Palace decoration. Joining us now is Eric Torkels. He's the editor of Budget Travel Magazine. He's with us from NPR's Bureau in New York. Nice to have you with us today.
Thank you.
And the latest issue of Budget Travel is based on readers' suggestions. We're sort of copying your format here today. Are people relying more and more on fellow travelers?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, if you look at the long view, what's happened in terms of how travelers get their information, they don't honestly trust guidebooks and experts the way they used to. They want to hear from real people like them who've stayed at that hotel. And a website like TripAdvisor, I mean, it's astounding what sort of brand awareness that has among travelers, considering it, you know, came to be, you know, less than 10 years ago.
And how do you edit through so much word-of-mouth tips and adventure stories?
Well, that's part of the charm. I mean, you know, you learn to love that or you're not going to want to work on Budget Travel, to tell you the truth. But for our anniversary issue, we devoted the whole issue to reader-generated stuff. And, you know, it's you learn very quickly. You tell whether it's going to be something good or something not. You look for voice. Does this sound like someone whose taste you trust? Do they have something interesting to say? You know, I mean, I was thinking, like, if someone says to you, no, this restaurant's really good, everyone was really nice, you're like, okay, well, I'm not sure what to do with that. But if someone says to you, this restaurant was amazing, I had this hamburger that it was the juiciest thing I've ever had. It was just, I mean, you know, you can tell that they have a sense of, they've thought about it, I guess, which is the difference. So you look for that.
But I assume, you know, if there's an office there, somebody shout, hey, anybody ever been to Peru?
Yeah, we're always doing that kind of thing. Of like, because, you know, we're always trying to find people who are, honestly, most of the magazine we put together involves finding someone who's an expert who lives somewhere already. Rather like you're doing by asking your listeners, the advice that's already come in is from people who live in those places.
Mm-hmm.
So our goal really is not to send people places and have them write about it, but to find people who already live there who can give that kind of inside information.
And an issue where I guess the writer's fees were pretty low, but maybe a lot of editing.
Well, we paid the same we pay normal writers to tell you the truth, but there was an extraordinary amount of editing because these are not professional writers. But you know, honestly, it was fascinating. We all learned so much. There's a story about sort of the 50 reasons you love New York, and I've lived in New York for 20 years now, and I learned so much. And not only did I learn it, it made me excited about it. I went through about 1,000 submissions one weekend day. This is how I spend my life. And I went through them, and then I took a long walk because I needed to get out. And I fell in love with it again.
Were there any you saved? I don't want to put this in the magazine. It'll be too popular. I'm going to go there myself.
No, you learn really quickly you can't do that. You got to get over it.
We're talking summer travel and looking for some great cheap things to do in your town. Give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. More on Talk of the Nation after a short break. This is NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We'll get to the opinion page a bit later this hour. Today, Frank Rich on Memorial Day at the revival of South Pacific in New York City. Right now, summer travel on a budget. We got this email from Maribeth about our earlier guest, Doug Diamond of OneBag.com. She wrote, my husband and I use tips from the OneBag website for a 10-day trip to Paris, and we will continue to use only one carry-on from now on. I even packed a pair of knee-high boots and had plenty of room. It has changed the way we travel. So that unsolicited endorsement. We want you to be our travel guides for the day. Tell us about the great cheap things to do in your town. We're looking for more than the usual tourist spots here. How can a visitor live like a local for a couple of days? 800-989-8255. Email talk@npr.org. And you can read what other listeners have to say on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. Our guest is Eric Torkels. He's editor-in-chief of Budget Travel Magazine. And let's get Chuck on the line. Chuck calling us from Oakland, California.
Hello, Neil.
Hi, Chuck.
Happy Memorial Day.
And happy Memorial Day to you.
I live in the San Francisco Bay Area, and across the Golden Gate Bridge from San Francisco is Sausalito. And in Sausalito is a place called the Bay Model. And it is a scale model of San Francisco Bay and the tributaries that lead to it. It actually has actual tidal movement. It was originally built by the Corps of Engineers to... they were thinking of, there was some plan to dam San Francisco Bay, and they wanted to measure the effect of it, but it's long since just been a tourist attraction. It's about two football fields large, and it's free.
And it's free.
Sponsored by the National Park Service.
And it must be amazing because San Francisco Bay is pretty amazing.
It is. It's one of my favorite attractions around here.
Thanks very much for the idea.
You're very welcome.
Appreciate it. Eric Torkels, you mentioned just before the break that there were a whole bunch of things about New York you didn't know. For instance...
Well, for instance, I mean, this is funny because a lot of people who live uptown know about this bakery, Levan Bakery, where it apparently has the best cookies ever. I love chocolate chip cookies, and I'd never heard of it. And I mentioned it to someone else recently, and they're like, oh, yeah, no, I live near that. I've been going there for years, you know. But we're all experts about something, and it's the trick is to sort of get in touch with each other. And then I think that we're so much more empowered to have better experiences.
Has the travel industry caught on to the way people are getting their information now?
Oh, absolutely. It's really interesting. I mean, TripAdvisor has revolutionized how people choose hotels. If you think about it, 20 years ago, you know, you had a brochure and a travel agent maybe, and you chose based on that. Well, now you can find not just reviews from people, although those are incredibly useful, but even photographs that people have taken of their stay at that hotel. I went to Pittsburgh for vacation recently, and I was staying at a nice hotel downtown, and, you know, looked nice. I mean, I don't know, whatever. So on a lark, actually, we went to TripAdvisor and looked at the photographs other travelers had taken. And it was like night and day. And it was so much true. When we got there, what it looked like was so much truer to what the other travelers had taken than what the hotel was posting on its own website.
Because you're getting actual pictures, not propaganda.
Exactly. I mean, you can't blame the hotel for making itself look good. I mean, you know, that's business. But you know, TripAdvisor has utterly changed it to the point where if you go to Sheraton's website, you know, they're actively soliciting for people's opinions about their stay and running it on their homepage because it validates it and it makes it seem accessible. I think there's something, you know, in our anniversary issue, we sent people all over the world. We sent a family of four to Hong Kong. And I think if you look at that story, what you take away from it is, you know, if they can go and have a great experience, and it's not that hard, whatever, I can go. And I think sometimes travel media gets out of touch with that.
It makes it sound daunting somehow.
Right. Well, you watch the Travel Channel, it's all so exciting and glamorous, and they're eating bugs, and they're, you know, doing all these strange things. And it's fun to watch, but it seems sort of like I could never do that. But the truth is, you know, you can go anywhere, and you can afford to go almost anywhere if you do it right. And I mean, that's our mantra.
Let's see if we can talk with Craig, and Craig's with us from Mexico Beach in Florida.
Hello. How are you doing?
Very well, thanks.
It's beautiful down here. It's unspoiled. It's probably the last unspoiled beach in America. The sand is sugar white, and we're in protected harbor, so we've never really suffered all the hurricane damage that's gone on these recent years or even years in the past. A lot of the houses here are from the 50s, 60s, and 70s, and even in the 80s. And we have, you know, we have dolphins and bald eagles and manatee in the rivers and all that stuff. It's just amazing.
Unspoiled, and you're announcing that on the radio.
Absolutely. Well, you know, the economy is still the American economy down here. So,
yeah,
you know, we need people.
I take it from the name Mexico Beach and your description of those pristine white sands, you've got to be on the Gulf of Mexico side up near Pensacola somewhere?
We're actually we're 30 minutes east of Panama City, right at the edge of Tyndall Air Force Base. So it's also a favorite place for aviation watchers. And for there's a long stretch of road along the beach. There's a giant public dedicated beach for miles and miles and miles that everybody likes to cruise their Harleys on. So it's kind of a motorcycle parade here every day.
So it's a combination of watch the manatees and the Harleys and the F-16s.
Yeah, well, you know, the one's in the water, one's in the air, and it's, you know, nobody seems to care about the noise because it's all so beautiful.
Thanks very much for the recommendation, Craig.
All right. Yeah, good one.
You too. Have you never been to Mexico Beach, Eric?
No, I have not. I did a road trip once along the Panhandle, but I don't recall stopping there.
Let's bring in Colleen Clark. She's an associate editor with Concierge.com, an online travel magazine. She's also with us from NPR's Bureau in New York. Nice to have you on the program as well.
Thanks, Neil.
And we mentioned eating bugs just a moment ago. You profiled some exotic street foods from around the world.
Yeah, I think street food goes farther than nearly any other travel experience to sort of quickly weave you into the culture of a place. So if you take banh mi, for example, in Vietnam, you're going to have a crusty French baguette, and that sort of gives you a sense of the French colonial past. Mm-hmm. And then inside you have this grilled pork, and you have crunchy pickled vegetables. And it sort of gives you a look at the, you know, historical look at the place in the form of a 32-cent sandwich that you get on the side of the road.
And Vietnam... Well, a lot of people might think it's not a great tourist location, but, well, a lot of people have been going there, having a great time, and cheap.
Oh, by far, one of the cheapest beach vacations. If you're talking about bang for your buck, you know, the flight's certainly more expensive, but you could end up doing, you know, a much longer and much cheaper vacation than going to Europe. And you actually get a lot of the European feel from places like Hua Hin. You'll have sort of like a French colonial feel without, you know, without the price tag.
We just mentioned Mexico Beach in Florida. How about Chowpatty Beach in Mumbai?
That's an excellent place for street food. Some people get a little bit concerned because the cleanliness standards of the food stands there aren't as high as they are in places like maybe Singapore or Thailand. But you can get a feel for that at other smaller restaurants in the city.
And how do you find some of these places?
Well, my technique, I think you should really focus on what your interests are. And, for example, when I went to Montreal, I'm really into music. And so the first thing I did when I got off the plane was I sort of went to the closest guitar shop and went up to, you know, one of the guys that was working there and said, hey, where do you go to listen to music? And by doing that, you know, he put me in touch with some really underground, great little bars. I ended up seeing a great French reggae band because, you know, something I never would have had access to through a guidebook or through a, you know, larger publication.
And Montreal, French reggae is not what first pops into mind.
They have a fantastic underground music scene there. And, you know, one night we saw a Montreal bluegrass band and the next it was French reggae.
Let's see if we get some more callers on the line. This is Terry. Terry's calling us from Juneau in Alaska.
Hey, how are you today?
I'm good today. How are you?
I'm great. It's a great, great, beautiful sunny day in Juneau, Alaska. We live on and I'm sitting here with my... We still have tons of snow. We went snowboarding yesterday on the island where we live. We hiked up to the ski area that closed about a month ago, a little over a month ago. And we hiked to the top of a mountain. We snowboarded down, and there's snow all the way to the lodge, and everybody's still snowboarding and skiing here this time of year.
On Memorial Day.
On Memorial Day, oh, for sure. And yesterday was my birthday. We did a birthday run. Today we're going to do a Memorial Day run.
Happy birthday, Terry.
Thanks.
It's 80 degrees here in Washington, and we haven't seen snow for quite a while. But the idea of 15 feet of snow at this time of the year, Eric Torkels, that sounds pretty interesting.
Yeah, I mean, we're finally having beautiful weather here in New York for the first time in a while, so I'm not sure I'm ready to trade that for 15 feet of snow.
Here's an email we have from Seth in Las Vegas. The International Pinball Hall of Fame, 10 minutes off the strip, no admission, 100-plus pinball machines ready, waiting, and well-maintained. $10 will easily last you 3 hours. That's a pretty good tip. Colleen Clark, is there any good street food in Las Vegas that you know about?
I think you're going to go a little pricier in Las Vegas than
probably.
Street food.
Here's an email we have from Paul. Every year, about 20,000 Civil War reenactors dress up and head for Gettysburg to play out the battle as it happened over the July 4th weekend. Gettysburg is close to many East Coast cities, including Morgantown, West Virginia, where I live. A ticket for the war can be had for about $80. Well, considering it's the whole Civil War, maybe $80 isn't such a bad price. Let's see if we can go now to EJ. EJ's with us from Lansing in Michigan.
Hi, how are you today?
Very well, thank you.
Oh, I want to tell you some of the best ice cream ever made is here at Michigan State University here in Lansing, the Lansing area. And nobody ever knows about it. I mean, Michigan State University is an agricultural college, and they have a dairy school, and that dairy school has a dairy store.
And do they make different flavors?
Oh, yeah. I remember when they first started out, they started out with like 3 or 4 flavors, and now they got like Baskin-Robbins, 30-some-odd flavors.
And do they rotate over time? I mean...
Oh, yeah, like they had, like when they were in the Final Four, they had something called Final Four Crunch or something like that, a special edition ice cream that they make just when they get to the Final Four.
And I assume there's some Spartan Sundae or something like that.
Oh, yeah, there's lots of stuff, and the ice cream scoops are only like a dollar, and they're huge. I mean, it's open year-round, and it's surprising. People go to the football games and basketball games, and they don't know that this is there.
EJ, thanks very much for the recommendation. Next time we're in Lansing.
Thanks. Bye.
Thanks very much. And Colleen Clark, can you give him a run for his money on ice cream?
Actually, there's a, you know, people only tend to think about street food in sort of the more developing countries, but I've found some pretty fantastic street food in New York. There's a new artisanal ice cream truck that's been going around town with ice cream that's been made from cows milked upstate the same day.
Mm-hmm.
And
that word you used, made by artisans, is that the idea?
Well, that's kind of the word people tend to use to make things sound a bit fancier.
I always interpret that as meaning expensive.
I think it tends to add a dollar or two to the scoops.
Exactly, but... yeah. Craftsman is another word that adds a dollar or two.
But yeah, I mean, New York has some fantastic street food now. Some of the best coffee or pastries or as I said, ice cream that you get now is found on the streets.
Eric Torkels, you agree?
Oh, absolutely. That's one of the fascinating trends going on in the food world right now are these vans that people who actually can cook and cook well are opening vans that they park in different parts of several cities all over the world. There's the coffee place called Mud in New York has a bright orange van. You see, it's a fantastic experience.
Here's an email from Fred in Chicago. My family and I just returned from a 1.5-hour canoe trip on the Chicago River on the north side of the city of Chicago. The rentals are done through the Park District. While canoeing in a very urban setting, we saw herons, turtles, gulls, ducks, Canadian geese, and all kinds of beautiful wildlife along the river. You also get to see the city in a way that most people don't get to see it, and the cost is $15 an hour. And for before we get emails, yes, we know they're Canada geese, not Canadian geese, and I apologize for the error. But anyway, there's a suggestion. If there's some great place cheap in your town, give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Let's talk with Troy. Troy's wedding's from Redding, California.
Oh, I was going to tell you about Mount Shasta and Mount Lassen, two volcanoes in the Redding area. Redding's about 180 miles north of Sacramento in California, and we have some of the best mountains in the area. Mount Lassen, you can actually hike all the way to the top. I think it's the highest mountain in the United States that you can just hike.
And is there 15 feet of snow on top of it like there is in Juneau?
No, unfortunately, the snow melts in the summer, but we do have really good skiing in Mount Shasta in the winter.
Okay, thanks very much for the idea, Troy.
Yep.
Bye-bye. And let's see if we can get another caller in, and we'll go to Jonathan. Jonathan with us from Mount Pleasant in Michigan.
Hi, how you doing?
Very well, thanks.
Well, I'm a geologist, and I found that one of the best ways to see this country or any other is to look for geology field guides. They'll give you a lot of information on what you're seeing. You can see a lot of the out-of-the-way places. Geologists spend a lot of time hunting down some of the most beautiful scenery in the country, and it also gives you great diners. We love greasy spoons and good bars, and so a lot of these are available on the internet for free, and or contact your local geology department for ideas. They spend a lot of time out on the road, and they like to do it cheap.
I've never heard that expression, eat like a geologist.
Well, that doesn't necessarily mean eating healthy, though.
Thanks very much for the idea, Jonathan.
Thank you very much. Have a good day.
Okay. And Colleen Clark, give us one or two recommendations of the great street food recommendations that you've seen. Which would you like to try?
Oh, man, that's a tough one. Let's see. Arepas? That's a favorite of mine. I've never had it on site. I've only had it in New York. But that's a great, great cheap street food to give a try. And the other thing which I'm reticent to try is fried frogs. When I was in Bangkok, my sister, she always collected frogs as a child. And when she was living there, I remember her calling me really traumatized because she was out with some Thai friends and they made her eat a little fried frog. And the poor things are sort of fried. And they look like they're still jumping out of the oil by the time you have to eat them.
I'm told it tastes like chicken.
Oh.
And let me ask you, Eric Torkels, if there was a one or two of the tips that you wanted to take advantage of, what would they be? And they were in your magazine this month.
Oh, gosh. And this month, you know, we had an interest. We asked people if they'd ever learned a lesson the hard way. This is a story I love because if you ask people if they just have good advice, they don't know what to tell you. But if you say, have you ever learned a lesson the hard way, they know. And people learned something really great who they went to a hotel and there was a hole burned into the bedspread. And they didn't say anything because they didn't do it, whatever. They didn't say anything. And when they checked out, the hotel charged them for it. And so their lesson for all of us is, if you see something wrong with your room, make a point of it right away or you might end up getting burned. Literally.
Interesting. Here's an email we have from Laura in Minnesota, writing from Minneapolis, but I want to make a plug for the destination in my hometown, Staten Island, New York, best known as the place the ferry goes to. Many visitors to New York City never step out of the ferry terminal, but just a few blocks away lies the Snug Harbor Cultural Center, once home for retired sailors, and now houses beautiful gardens, a lovely restaurant, historic buildings, and galleries. The center puts on concerts and festivals, exhibits and art classes. It's a wonderful place to explore with children. My kids love to go there when we visit family. It's worth getting off the boat. Well, that plug for Staten Island. And this from Jim in Moorhead, Minnesota. Moorhead, Minnesota has the, well, I don't know how to pronounce this, Jemkoms Center, Jemkoms, which houses a Viking ship replica built by a local school teacher and sailed to Norway by his children. A very touching story of courage and a dream come true. Well, that's what to do in Moorhead, Minnesota. And Eric Torkels, thanks very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Eric Torkels is editor-in-chief of Budget Travel Magazine. He's joined us from NPR's Bureau in New York. There with him in the New York Bureau is also Colleen Clark, associate editor with Concierge.com. And thanks very much for your time today.
Thank you.
And coming up on Talk of the Nation, the opinion page, new meaning for a Broadway standard. Frank Rich of the New York Times on Memorial Day and a revival of the Rodgers and Hammerstein musical South Pacific. Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And now time for the Talk of the Nation opinion page. In New York this Memorial Day, a revival of the Rodgers and Hammerstein musical South Pacific is the hottest ticket in town. The show, which has been nominated for 11 Tony Awards, has been sold out for months. New York Times columnist Frank Rich calls it the most unexpected cultural sensation the city has experienced in a while. Audiences, he says, start to tear up as soon as they hear the overture. It's the first Broadway revival of South Pacific in nearly 60 years. Like any good musical, there's romance and laughter, and there are plenty of catchy songs, but it isn't light. The plot centers on two weighty issues, war and race. And that, Frank Rich says, makes it very relevant, perhaps unexpectedly relevant today. Frank Rich joins us now from his home in Manhattan. It's nice to have you on the program today.
Nice to be with you.
The most common remark from those who've seen the show, you write, is, "I couldn't stop myself. I was sobbing."
If you walk around New York or presumably outside New York and talk to people who've seen South Pacific since it started performing in March, it is remarkably common how that response is, including among men as well as women and seemingly of all generations. And I think the show touches something that's very much with us right now in terms of our own relationship to the war in Iraq, of course, and also by happenstance this pioneering musical about racial issues just happened to be produced when race, to really no one expected this in advance, became a big issue in the presidential campaign this election year.
And how does a musical about soldiers training for an invasion in the South Pacific in 1942, how does that relate to Iraq, do you think?
Well, I think we have a strange relationship to the war in Iraq. Most of us don't know people who are serving there. Iraq has almost dropped off the radar screen in media coverage, maybe not on NPR or the New York Times, but in most places. And it's sort of a suppressed, maybe slightly guilty concern of all of us. We see these men and women in South Pacific fighting in the so-called good war, or waiting to fight because they're basically waiting for what would be a huge and bloody battle against Japan. And we start to make correspondences, what adds up and what doesn't. And one of the most interesting things about South Pacific is it was written almost like with newspaper freshness after the war. It was based on a book that came out in 1947, James Michener's novel, Tales of the South Pacific. It was immediately adapted by Rodgers and Hammerstein and Joshua Logan to the stage. It opened in April of 1949. Most of the people sitting in the audience then had relatives who had served in the war or maybe been killed there. and it has a different attitude. You get a sense of the duty of these people, but you also get the sense that they're human. They joke, they connive, they want to have sex, all these sort of human things that we kind of have put aside as the Iraq War has become so distant and the people who are fighting it have become essentially political pawns on one side or the other. This brings back the humanity of these people, and also, I have to say, the importance of their mission, even though they didn't regard it in a sort of self-aggrandizing way as important. We knew what we were fighting for then. I think a lot of people don't know quite what we're doing in Iraq and haven't known for some time.
Also, by being so fresh, you say it avoids being seen through that sort of scrim of sentimentality.
Right. You know, right before 9/11, World War II was sort of rebranded as this uplifting event. And, of course, it was uplifting in many ways. We fought a war that, in my view at least, had to be fought against rapacious and truly horrible enemies. But nonetheless, it was kind of sanitized. It was the Greatest Generation. It was the Band of Brothers. It was almost as if in the late 1990s, when we really had no cause in this country, we were trying to sort of glom on to World War II, or in my case, my parents' generation war, and weren't really assessing what went on or what it was really like. And, of course, that all sort of evaporated after 9/11, and South Pacific further corrects the record, because this is not a nostalgic piece about the war. This was written at the time, more or less, and it's how it felt to the people who actually fought it and the home front that actually lived through it.
And unlike a lot of Rodgers and Hammerstein musicals, which are still pretty popular, South Pacific sort of fell into a black hole.
It did. It's very strange, because it was actually one in its original run on Broadway. It and Oklahoma had the two longest runs by far. And yet in the years since, Oklahoma and even less successful shows originally, such as Carousel and The Sound of Music, and even Flower Drum Song, have had major revivals on Broadway. I think part of it was Vietnam. I think that that sort of put the kibosh on any kind of musical about war, particularly one that people think was a just war, or many people do. At the same time, there was the movie version in 1958, which is what most people think of when they
sure.
see South Pacific, because they haven't seen the real thing, which really misrepresented the piece. I didn't realize how off that movie was. I knew it wasn't a great movie, but until I saw this extraordinary production at Lincoln Center in New York, I didn't realize how much it sanitized and sentimentalized it. It was almost like a product of suburban 1950s boom America than the original Rodgers and Hammerstein show of 10 years earlier.
Yeah, mostly interesting because you realized My Favorite Martian did something before that show.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. And in fact, actually, Ray Walston, we can't blame the movie on him. He had been in the London Company and on the road in South Pacific. But they it's shocking to see this version where even on stage now, where even songs like Happy Talk, which, because of that movie, we think of as sort of a sentimental, throwaway, silly song, have an edge to them and has an edge to it, and even about things like race.
And that is the most surprising thing. Again, I've seen the movie. I've never seen the show. And the way you write about the racial tension in that production and put it back in the time in which it is set and the time in which it first appeared on Broadway, it's remarkable.
Well, it's incredibly moving. You know, the heroine of the show is a woman in her early 30s who's wanted to get away from her home of Little Rock, Arkansas. She's white, obviously. She's a nurse. She is a product of her conventional upbringing of that time. She falls in love with an expatriate French planter who lives in the South Pacific on the island she goes to, whom she discovers had a now late Polynesian wife and has two young children by this guy. And she has an incredible dilemma, and that is the real, in some ways, the real structure of the entire show. And what's fascinating about it is everyone thinks it's going to be dated and a dated view of, you know, civil rights before the real civil rights movement. But the genius of Rodgers and Hammerstein is Nellie Forbush, who is presented to the audience as a racist at the beginning of the show, is the most lovable character you could imagine, and not in a saccharine way, in a human way. And so as we see her go through these changes and try to figure out where she fits into a world that's changing about race as well as war, it has a profound and very moving effect, and it's not at all sentimental. And keep in mind that this was 8 years before Little Rock exploded at Central High School in racial violence when this show opened on Broadway, and at a time when racially mixed marriages were illegal in many American states. So imagine an audience sitting in Times Square in 1949 watching this and watching her make these choices, and it's so honestly done by Rodgers and Hammerstein that they still speak to people, particularly now as we're weighing all the issues that obviously have been raised during Obama's run for the presidency.
There's one word in the script that has been the occasion of a lot of argument.
Yes. In the original script that Rodgers and Hammerstein went into rehearsal with, Nellie Forbush uses the word colored and sort of shocked when she discovers this about the late wife of the man she loves. A harsher word was used by Michener, actually, in the original novel. In 1949, however, Rodgers and Hammerstein made the decision to throw out that word, not use it. It's now restored. It's the only significant textual change from the original 1949 version. And it lands in the audience in such a way, even though it's a relatively mild word for to express bigotry, I guess, because we like this woman and we like and we also like these children that we wish that she liked and could accept, it really hits people hard. And then when you wed that to this incredible score that these guys wrote, it takes the musical theater part of it takes it to another dimension that's quite searing, I think.
And that's an odd part of it, because while the show itself, as you write, has been in a black hole all these years, those songs have not.
Those songs have entered the American language. Even people who don't know where they come from know phrases like "some enchanted evening" or "there's nothing like a dame," "younger than springtime," "I'm as corny as Kansas in August." But we've only heard them in a secondary way, it turns out. You hear them sung by these people on stage, and it's quite different from hearing them, in Muzak in a lobby or in all those sort of bowlerized ways they've been done in recent years. It's almost as jarring as hearing, say, John Coltrane do a version of My Favorite Things from Sound of Music, which has no relationship to the way it's sung in the show. This is the flip side of that. We think we've heard these songs, but we don't really know who's singing and how powerful the thoughts and feelings are that they're expressing.
And whether it was at the Lowe's Strabismus or on late night television, we think we've seen the production, but you say the show looks very different from that big Technicolor production.
Yeah, that Technicolor production was at the height of the explosion of widescreen color film. I believe it was made in the so-called long-gone Todd A.O. 70-millimeter process. And it really was as much travelogue as musical, and everything was sort of made cuter, funnier, broader. There was no real charge, with the emotional or sexual charge between the two leads as there is in this production, as I gather there was between Mary Martin and Ezio Pinza in 1949. So it's almost as if it's a neutered South Pacific, and it's shocking. It'd almost be instructional for children to be taken to the version at Lincoln Center and then to see the movie. You'd learn so much about how a text can be transformed by the way it's produced. And this production right now hasn't reinvented the wheel. It's not some modern updating. It's not avant-garde. It's just going with what Rodgers and Hammerstein wrote and playing it for the reality that's there. And it turns out if a script is written honestly, emotionally and intellectually and creatively from the get-go, you can find it with great performers and a great director like Bartlett Scheer, who did this production.
And there's a last scene which you describe seemingly very mundane, very strange for the last scene of a big musical, which has extraordinary power.
It does. You think these Rodgers and Hammerstein, would end a show like Oklahoma with everyone singing Oklahoma at the top of their lungs, or Sound of Music with the Climb Every Mountain. This ends with the simple act of Emile Debeck, played by Paolo Zott, Nellie Forbush, played by Kelly O'Hara, and these two mixed-race children sitting down for a meal, which, by the way, is exactly the way it ended in 1949. And you look at that family, and there's no dialogue really to it. There's just a thread of music, and the whole audience is just, I think, thunderstruck and tearful, because somehow it becomes a way by which we measure where we stand on all these issues, each individual member of the audience right. and American society as a whole. And because it's so real and unsentimental, right. You respond to it as if it's people you know. And what's your reaction to them? What do you think about this? What progress have these characters made over the time during which South Pacific is set? What progress have they not made? And it's very powerful, and I think sends the audience out with something to really think about and brood upon as well as to be moved by.
Frank Rich, thanks very much.
Thank you.
You can find a link to Frank Rich's Memorial Day at South Pacific on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News.